Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President urging American parents to vaccinate their children in the face of a measles epidemic that is spreading across the country, even though measles were declared eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. Arthur Kaplan, Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health, joins us to discuss the irresponsible remarks by Republican presidential candidates Rand Paul and Chris Christie, who apparently feel they have to challenge anything and everything the president stands for, including Obama's seemingly uncontroversial advice to parents that you should get your kids vaccinated. Then we'll examine the president's $4 trillion budget proposal to Congress that, like everything else sent to the Republican-controlled Congress, is dead on arrival. Scott Klinger, the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government, joins us to discuss the president's six-year, $478 billion infrastructure plan to revamp and modernize our highways, airports, bridges, and mass transit systems, to be paid for with a one-time 14% tax on the $2.1 trillion corporate earnings stashed abroad, instead of the 35% corporate rate that nobody pays. Then finally, we will look into the president's $585 billion 2016 budget for the Pentagon that reverses a five-year drop in military spending. Mandy Smithberger, director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight, joins us to discuss the extra $11 billion for the overpriced and underperforming F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, while the Air Force continues to try to kill the A-10, which is popular with the troops, in order to find another $3.5 billion for the problem-plagued F-35 program, and the extra $821 million for 29 MQ-9 Reaper drones. And joining us now is Arthur Kaplan, who's a professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD/Medscape. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arthur Kaplan.
Thanks for having me.
And in terms of this measles outbreak and the questions arising from a number of American parents who do not vaccinate their children, the president was forced to weigh in saying, the science is, you know, pretty indisputable. We've looked at this again and again. There is every reason to get vaccinated, but there aren't reasons to not. You should get your kids vaccinated. As a medical ethicist, I mean, I'm sure you find it puzzling in the first place why parents don't vaccinate their kids.
I do, because not only is it the right thing to do to keep your kids healthy, it's the right thing to do to keep other kids healthy. You're not much of a good neighbor, you're not much of a community member, knowing that there are newborns out there that can't be vaccinated, or kids with cancer whose immune systems are down, or who've had a transplant, they have no immunity. Those things like the flu and measles will kill them. And you have a duty, I think, to watch out for them as well as your own kid.
And it seems tragic, in a way, that measles was declared eliminated in 2000 in this country.
Well, it was completely predictable. Most Americans still do the right thing and vaccinate, but there have been pockets of people, many in California, who have not been vaccinating their kids. And it was only a matter of time until we got measles or mumps or whooping cough really fired up and at epidemic levels. And measles is probably one of the most contagious diseases there is. It also has nasty consequences. Probably 3 out of 1,000 people die from it. Probably 1 in 100 have to go to the hospital to be rescued from it. So it's not a trivial disease, but having people, pockets of people who don't vaccinate is really a rapid route to getting it to spread.
So let's talk about herd immunity then, to give the public, Arthur Kaplan, an understanding of the logic of why everybody has to be immunized.
So if you look at the measles vaccine, it's a very good one. It's very, very safe. There's no link, none, nada, zero to autism. It's a very safe vaccine, but it only is about 95% effective in the average kid. So the more people you vaccinate, the harder the measles has a task of finding someone to infect. So if a room of 30 people vaccinate, only 5% are uninfected, if you will, then should somebody appear with the measles, there's much better protection the more people vaccinated than if you just rely on individual vaccination. That's called herd immunity. It just means the virus has a harder time spreading from person to person, even with a vaccine, because like everything else, vaccines are not 100% effective. The measles vaccines are really good, but it does leave a few people who don't react to it.
So what percentage of people not vaccinating their children reaches a threshold where herd immunity ceases to exist? I mean, it's a pretty low number, isn't it?
It is. If you get much above 8% in a community or a subpopulation, in other words, you live in a town where fewer than 92% of people are vaccinating, you're losing the herd immunity and you're setting up for the measles spread. And that's exactly where the measles has been going. That's exactly where the spread has been going, into those communities first.
And one of the paradoxes, of course, is these, some of these communities out here in California and Marin County and in Orange County are wealthy, high-income communities where people are fairly well-educated.
Yeah, so I think there's two sources of resistance to vaccines. One is fears about autism. Hopefully we've tamped those down, made them go away. There's a mountain of literature showing whatever autism is caused by, it's not vaccines. In fact, I've got research colleagues here who are starting to diagnose vaccines. I've got research colleagues here at my medical center who are starting to diagnose children with autism before vaccination. So it's clear that that can't be the cause. We have many countries that don't use or have poor vaccination rates that still have increasing autism rates, and autism rates have been increasing while vaccination is going down. So the connection just doesn't make any sense. Whatever it is, and it's tragic, it isn't vaccines. But people still hear that, believe that. There's still people, celebrities, media people who do appear spreading what I consider nonsense. The other view is don't put poisons in your body. And I hear that from folks who are very organic, very green. However, these are the exact same people that let the baby sleep with a cat or let the dog lick their kid. And if you looked at the amount of dangerous things, the dog is going to beat the vaccine by, shall we say, 1,000 to 1 in terms of dangerous microbes. So there's nothing, if you will, poisonous in a vaccine. It's just small bits of what are circulating out there naturally. It's just that sometimes what's out there naturally isn't good for you.
Well, there's also this paradox amongst the anti-vaxxers, as they're called, and that is that they have a suspicion of Big Pharma, and they take this anti-science position. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, for example, they criticize a lot of Republicans, and particularly presidential candidates, for being against the science of global warming, too. I mean, I just don't understand. There's no intellectual consistency here to be. Yeah, I guess it has more to do with a pervasive suspicion of government, which you have in this country on both the left and the right.
Well, I think there is suspicion of pharma, but let's go at that head on. I'd much rather pharma make money from selling us prevention than selling us cures. And pharma is very happy to sell us cures. They make a lot more money that way. If you have an HPV vaccine that prevents cervical cancer, it's much cheaper at $500 a pop than, say, $10,000 a pop to treat cervical cancer with surgery and medicines. So everybody knows, even those well-educated people know, that prevention is cheaper than treatment. And I'll put it another way. I'm very glad in the auto industry if people who make brakes make a lot of money. I don't care if pharma makes money preventing disease. I think that's a very good thing. I think if we could push pharma and biotech toward prevention, that would be a wonderful thing.
Again, I'm speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who's a professor of bioethics and the director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD/Medscape. And it is pretty depressing that in our country, a lot of people get their medical advice from a former Playboy model, Jenny McCarthy, and a talk show host, Oprah Winfrey. But now they're also getting their medical and scientific information from a presidential candidate, Chris Christie, who in London waded into this vaccination debate by saying that believes the US government must balance public health interests with parental choice, and saying that parents should have, quote, some measure of choice about immunizing their children from measles and other viruses. So this is peculiar, coming from a man who forced a woman who had been treating Ebola patients in West Africa, who had tested negative for the disease. She was forced into quarantine by Chris Christie against her own will. So here he is now, he's saying that personal choice trumps the public good in terms of measles, but the opposite with Ebola.
Right. I've been writing about that today. It's clear that Chris Christie, while perhaps marginally more insightful than some of our celebrities, is not much more so, because he basically said around the Ebola quarantine issue, public health has to triumph. We need to do everything we can to protect the public health, and if that means quarantine for some, so be it. When it comes to vaccination, apparently he doesn't care about the public health. He is now saying in London, well, individual rights have to count, and we don't want to put the public health ahead of that. We need a balance. So my view is Christie hasn't quite figured out which viruses he likes, which he doesn't like. He apparently is hostile to Ebola, but isn't so uncomfortable with measles. And I say that with all the cynicism intended. You know, you cannot have government officials playing roulette with public health. And that's what his statements did. I know Rand Paul has said something like that today, too, as well, similar. Vaccination isn't something that should be up for debate anymore. Government should simply say, look, you ought to do it. It's something we require you to do for your kids. It's equivalent to child abuse, unless there's a health reason not to vaccinate them. It's dangerous to others. You're putting other kids at real risk by not doing this. You stink as a community member if you won't vaccinate, and we're going to do everything we can to promote it.
Well, Rand Paul specifically said that I am not anti-vaccine at all, but particularly most of it ought to be voluntarily. And he then went on to say that what happens if you have somebody not wanting to take the smallpox vaccine and it ruins it for everyone else? I think there are times in which there can be some rules, but for the first part, it ought to be voluntary. Now, of course, he's coming from a libertarian point of view.
And I believe he's channeling Ayn Rand, who basically would have said, you know, I'm an individual, I'm selfish, I don't care about the community. Well, if that's the philosophy that he wants to espouse or you want to vote for, so be it. It doesn't seem to me that's a moral outlook that's going to be constructive and optimal for society, to just say, I'm going to do what I want to do.
Well, I have, as it happens, I've got a couple of friends who had polio just at the very end. Arthur Kaplan, one is a movie director who made a movie Sessions. I don't know whether you saw it.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Which was a very, I think, a really powerful and very touching movie about a man in an iron lung who contacted polio and who had never experienced any sexual relationship. And it's based on a true story. And another is a very famous specialist on education, whose TED Talk is one of the leading TED Talks. And I spent a lot of time with my friend in particular, the filmmaker. And, you know, it's tough to have to live with polio. And it was an amazing thing that for decades, parents were in terrible fear of their children. You know, every time they got a cold and a fever, they thought, my God, my kid's going to contract polio and be crippled for life. And this is, people were living with this. And then along came Jonas Salk, and this vaccine literally eliminated it. Not entirely, because, you know, now people aren't vaccinating. I mean, do you understand, or do you have a handle on why it is that people don't see the obvious, the benefits?
Well, I think, sadly, vaccines did their job and got rid of a lot of diseases. Polio, gone. Smallpox, gone. Tetanus, pretty much gone. Measles, once gone. Mumps, once gone. And people got lax, and they said, you know, I don't like needles. I don't really want to make my kid cry. I never saw a case of any of these things. maybe I have some worries about their safety, I'm not going to do it. It's foolish because the diseases will roar back. If you ask anyone today who lives in a poor third world nation, what is the best foreign assistance we've ever given them for health? It's vaccination. It's the Gates polio eradication campaign. It's the effort to get rid of cholera through vaccine, rotavirus and or diarrhea in infants through vaccine. I think they look at us as slightly crazy when we say vaccination. I'm not sure we should do that.
Well, but we've just gone through Ebola, and enormous efforts were made to create a vaccine.
Still underway.
Right.
And if Ebola had spread into the U.S., I think many of those who say, I'm not sure about vaccination, including Rand Paul and Chris Christie, would have been first in line to get their kids vaccinated.
The CDC is weighing in, I take it, the Center for Disease Control.
Yes.
And what?
And you know, you're getting the CDC, more movingly to me, the American Association of Pediatricians, California State Association, people who dedicate their lives to kids, and I don't think are under the thumb of the pharmaceutical industry or trying to hide facts about autism and so on, they say vaccinate. There are plenty of pediatricians out there who would say, if you won't do this, don't come to see me because you're not doing right by your child. So organized medicine, particularly those who deal with children, there's no hesitancy to recommend vaccines. We've got a few outliers, as there are on any issue, who sort of say, I don't know, but the mainstream is there. The support from those who know kids' health best is there. So I don't think there should be much doubt about what's the best course of action to take.
Well, we know, for example, that the Amish have religious objections. But what then, I mean, what is the origin of this personal choice or personal belief waiver that California parents were given? Did that directly come from that phony study in the Lancet that was subsequently repudiated?
It did. It came from this horrific study done by Andrew Wakefield, who had his license pulled, and he turned out to have a big conflict of interest because his claim that autism was caused by the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine or whooping cough vaccine, that was in the service of a lawsuit against vaccine manufacturers. So the study's never been repeated. It's been debunked eight ways to Sunday. But it got into the internet, it got into the heads of some people, like Jenny McCarthy, looking for an explanation as to why their kids were sick, and I understand that. They want some reason. Why has this happened? We all want some reason. Why is the autism epidemic getting worse? But unfortunately, making vaccines the culprit just leaves us open to worse health problems.
And what explains this doctor down in Orange County? Is it Bob Sears is his name?
Mm-hmm.
What's his story, and why is he taken seriously?
So his story is that he tried to find an accommodation by stretching out the vaccine schedule. He kept saying, well, maybe you're getting too many at once. Spread them out over time. Now, all that does is leave your kid vulnerable to diseases for longer periods of time. But again, the notion that you're getting too many at once, well, I'm not saying it's fun to get shots, I understand that, but the content of what's in a vaccine is so tiny, so small, that it's ridiculous to say it's going to overwhelm your immune system. Your immune system, if you where I live, if you wander the streets of New York, or for that matter, Los Angeles, you're going to be challenged by much, much more in the way of threats to your health than anything you're going to get in a vaccine. And I mean that immunologically, what's flying around in the air, people sneezing on you, all kinds of immune challenges. And that's just the reality of nature. Nature can be good and it can be your friend, but there are plenty of hostile things out there, microbes, bugs, that would love to take you or your kid out. So the reality is his science doesn't make any sense either.
Well, would Bob Sears' science then explain why there's this pocket of anti-vaxxers in Orange County?
It does, because they listen to that and they think, well, maybe too many vaccines all at once is a bad thing. But it's almost like saying, you know, if you had a terrible bleeding wound, too many bandages and too many ways to stop your blood from leaking out of you, that's too much. Do it gradually. It makes no sense whatsoever.
So do you think that then this measles outbreak, assuming it's contained, is a kind of wake-up call? And I mean, you know, I suppose there's a certain level of resistance that people have, people who believe conspiracy theories like that the 9/11 was an inside job, you know, they provide, you know, reams and reams of sort of factoids and pseudoscience and quack studies, and you, if you enter into those arguments, you just, your brain starts to hurt, you know. So, you know, there's a certain level where a certain number of people you simply can't convince that have almost a religious belief in conspiracy. But in general, do you think the tide is turning?
I do. I think this measles outbreak, particularly coming as it did in Disneyland, you know, when Goofy got the measles, the whole country sneezed, so to speak. It's symbolic that this particular epidemic came from an idyllic and pure place, if you will. And I think there is a bit of a wake-up call. You're right. There are some hardcore folks that won't change their minds ever about this issue. But I think there's many who will and who listen. And I do notice that some anti-vaxxers have gone down to the pediatrician and said, I changed my mind. I want the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine in the middle of this epidemic, which is to the good. I think the anti-vaxxers have had a lot of stage time. The measles epidemic has changed that. Now we're realizing that vaccination is a good thing, a smart thing. It's the right thing to do. And I suspect we'll see states start to toughen up the requirements for getting exemption. California weakened them. I think the measles epidemic was a result, made it too easy to opt out. I think you can make it tougher to opt out.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Arthur Kaplan.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who's a professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD/Medscape. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the president's $4 trillion budget proposal to Congress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He was a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a Security Analyst and Portfolio Manager for Walden Asset Management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you, Ian.
And in the president's new budget that he has just announced, he's proposing close to half a trillion dollars in infrastructure spending to modernize our highways, bridges, and mass transit systems across the country. And frankly, I've always been astounded why it is with record low, the cost of money is at a record low with interest rates around zero, why it is that the U.S. has not been able to invest in its crumbling infrastructure. We just had a bridge collapse the other day, and the prognosis is so terrible that every time you drive over a bridge, you're going to have to hold your breath. And every time, you know, and the planes are almost crashing into each other, and it's clearly a national disgrace, but yet there's total paralysis. So is this budget, you know, another lofty attempt at doing what's needed to be done, but it's going to be greeted with derision, scorn, and paralysis?
Well, I'm afraid that your analysis is right. The U.S. used to have infrastructure that was the pride of the world, and we've been surpassed by many countries, including countries that many of us would consider middle-income countries, much less well-off than our own. And if we don't address this, we're really posing a competitive threat to our markets and to our business activity. That threat is right realized both by Republicans and Democrats, but unfortunately we are continued to live in the scripts of austerity budgeting in which we don't want to spend money on anything. One bigger picture item from the president's budget is it's proposing the lowest level of discretionary spending for non-military activities that's ever been seen since these records were kept in 1962. So as a share of our economy, we're spending less on all the things like education and health care and infrastructure than we've spent since the 1960s.
But are the Koch brothers going to build the infrastructure the country needs? I mean, what is gripping the Republicans? I understand the libertarian philosophy underpins a lot of the Koch brothers, but you know, they've managed to buy a big chunk of the Republican Party. What in God's name do they think that the infrastructure somehow appears magically, or that there's some free enterprise way to do it? What's their theory?
Well, the problem, the Koch brothers and many other business CEOs and businesses don't want to pay taxes, and corporate taxes have continued to be in a very low level, even though business profits in the stock market are at record levels. We think one of the answers is, in terms of fixing our budget problems and having money to infrastructure, is asking corporations to pay their fair share for the infrastructure that they use. They deliver products over the roads. They depend on schools to educate their workers. They depend on courts to defend their contracts and patents and things like that. And they should be paying their fair share for those services. And instead, they've used high-priced lobbyists and expensive accountants to whittle down their taxes. So in many cases, they're paying very, very little towards the common good. We think that needs to change.
Well, so does President Obama, though, doesn't he? I mean, he wants to go after these overseas profits stashed abroad, not to mention all of these incredible offshore tax dodges.
So the president has proposed in his budget taxing a one-time tax on the $2 trillion of corporate money that's held offshore. Some of that money is offshore because companies are doing legitimate business overseas. Auto companies are building cars in Germany and selling them to Germans, or food companies are making foodstuffs in Japan and selling it to people in Asia. But an awful lot of it has been moved there. The profits that have been earned in the U.S. have been moved there through accounting tricks. A company will take its patent, a drug company will take its patent and register it in a place like the Cayman Islands or in Liechtenstein that don't tax corporate assets. And then every time someone buys a pill, they send a good chunk of the cost they paid for the pill to the Cayman Islands to pay for that patent. Even though they have no employees or no assets or no buildings in the Cayman Islands, they have a post office box and a brass plaque on the wall. And the U.S. tax code allows that sort of thing. Most Americans think that's outrageous, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, and that's what needs to stop. So the president's proposing that we tax all that $2 trillion at 14% instead of the 35% that it's supposed to be taxed at. And we think that's wrong. We think that rate is way too low, and it doesn't do anything to stem the tremendous flow of money that's going out of this country into tax havens. So we liken it to an analogy of a farmer who's got a hole in his fence through which horses are escaping. No farmer in his right mind would go out and round up the horses and put them back in the corral without first fixing the hole in the fence. So the president needs to fix that hole.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a Security Analyst and Portfolio Manager for Walden Asset Management. So in President Obama's $4 trillion budget, which was released on Monday, we've talked about his six-year-long proposal to build $478 billion worth of infrastructure to modernize our highways, bridges, and mass transit systems. And we also touched on overseas money. Recently, Scott, I was struck by how Apple, which is a corporation that most people feel good about because they like their products, and their products are incredibly popular, that they posted the biggest quarterly earnings in the history of American capitalism, bigger than ExxonMobil. So there's a lot of companies that are generating enormous amounts of profit. Why is it that there's nowhere for these American companies to put their money? What's wrong with our capitalist system that you can't find good places to invest money?
Well, I think part of it is that businesses have lost their sense of social responsibility in terms of providing jobs in this country to people. Many of them are moving their jobs to low-cost places of the world where they're paying very low wages to people who are very poor. And not investing in this country where people need jobs. We still have quite high unemployment and very high long-term unemployment in this country that hasn't fallen that much, even though there has been some job growth. And so we really need businesses to think about what's in their best interest. They're far too focused on quarterly earnings, not on the long-term health of the country. One of the reasons why we think investing in infrastructure makes a lot of sense is it also creates a lot of jobs. When we starve the government for revenue, we starve the job creation aspect that revenue can create. If we hire more teachers, we get more jobs. If we spend money to hire more road construction people, we get more jobs. And all of these things will also have the benefit of then generating additional tax revenue if more people are working. So we think there's a win-win in funding things like infrastructure and education that have been cut a lot recently.
Well, the Republicans spokesperson Paul Ryan, of course, has been getting away with the most outrageous claims for the longest time. And he has done everything he can to cut taxes for the rich. And in his budget proposals, he's done everything he can to punish the poor. And yet somehow he tries to pass himself off as a champion of the middle class. In terms of tax fairness, what's in this budget? I mean, just to remind the audience that at the time of the halcyon days of the American dream under President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the richest Americans paid 92% tax. Now they pay, 15%. Mitt Romney paid something like 13%. So that those are the realities. They've done incredibly well under George W. Bush, and I just don't understand why it is somebody can't cut through that nonsense and basically say, okay, you guys have had a terrific run. You got more money than you know what to do with. The 1% are getting richer and richer, or the 1% of the 1% are getting so rich it's ridiculous, and the rest of us need a little bit of a break here.
Well, that's right. And, the inequality that we see in the economy is not good for American businesses. No matter how rich you are, you may be able to buy $500,000 car, but how many cars do you need? It's much better to have that money in the hands of 100 families instead of one family, so you can buy 100 cars. That will put more people to work and help the economy. Likewise, restaurant meals, homes, all sorts of things that people spend money on. If you have a middle class that is struggling to get by, to pay their mortgage and to put some food on their table, they're not going to have a lot of disposable income that can create other jobs and keep other families afloat. If it's all concentrated in the hands of increasingly fewer numbers of rich people, that doesn't do much to recirculate through the economy. So one good thing that's in the president's budget is closing some of the loopholes that allow very, very rich family billionaires to escape paying estate tax. The estate tax is the nation's most progressive tax. It falls most heavily on very wealthy people. I think last year it fell on only 1,000 people or a couple thousand people out of the millions that died. So it's not the death tax that people that the right has tagged it with. It's only a tax on very great fortunes. Closing some of these loopholes that have allowed billionaires to literally escape taxes when they die on $1 billion or more of income will both raise money and help get some of this money back into circulation so it can benefit the middle class and working people.
Well, I don't know whether you've noticed, Scott, because I think you've been abroad, and you mentioned earlier in a conversation before we went on the air that you were just in Turkey, where you couldn't believe how much building and infrastructure is going on there compared to what's not happening here in the United States. But recently, Mitt Romney, who just dropped out of the presidential race, he accused Obama of not taking care of America's poor, and that the working Americans have had a bad deal. And Jeb Bush has echoed the same thing. And I find that pretty extraordinary that these Republicans, whose policies will be to continue to reward the rich and punish the poor, are able to say these things, because Obama's out there touting this great jobs recovery, but jobs are back, but wages aren't. Wages in this country have not gone up since 1973.
Right, and lots of people still don't have jobs. So I think we're concerned that Democrats' message is kind of happy days are returning, and that's not felt by people. So they kind of reject the rest of the Democratic plan and policies. And when people like Governor Romney or Governor Bush start with, "We know you're suffering," people feel like there's someone listening, and then they buy the rest of the stuff that follows that. So we would prefer the Democrats to have a little more compassion for kind of the realities that Americans are facing, including the fact that you just said that wages aren't going up and people are really struggling to get by. That's a much better entry to the conversation instead of look at all the great things we've done when people don't feel that.
So who, apart from Elizabeth Warren, is there anybody that you can identify, and of course Bernie Sanders would be another one, that are actually discussing the reality of where the real American statistics are and how they're impacting the lives of Americans without all of this happy talk?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are probably the two brightest spots on the national scene. I think there's probably also some mayors that are doing a decent job in some of the bigger cities around the country. But, you know, I think this is something we need to come to terms with, that, you know, we all want to believe that America is the best country on earth and everyone's succeeding and the streets are paved with gold. But that's not been the reality ever, and certainly not the reality now. So one of the ways that we need to contend with this is by investing more, by investing in our people, in our infrastructure, in our school buildings. We have thousands of school buildings that are inadequate. I think over half the school buildings were built to educate the baby boomers who are now retiring. You know, we see sports stadiums that are built at great cost and replaced in 20 years or 30 years, and corporate office towers that are demolished to make room for bigger and better ones. But when it comes to educating our kids, we think nothing of putting them in a school that's 60 or 70 or even 100 years old that may not have air conditioning and have a leaky roof and all sorts of things. So, you know, we need to live up to the values that we all hold dear, and we need to invest to make sure that we can have the sort of country that we inherited from our parents and our grandparents.
So what would you say then to Paul Ryan, who, in response to the president's budget, says, what I think the president is trying to do here is to again exploit envy economics?
Well, I think, you know, maybe one of the best responses comes from Warren Buffett, who said, you know, is there class warfare going on in America? And he said, absolutely, and my class is winning. I don't think Congressman Ryan's, you know, analysis holds a candle to what most Americans are feeling when they see who's getting by with more and more and who's getting by with less and less. The wealthiest individuals are benefiting and the most powerful corporations are benefiting, and small and medium-sized businesses are suffering, and working families and middle-class people are struggling to hold on.
But surely there's got to be some people in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party, too, that have some sense of reality and some sense of fiscal responsibility. I mean, for example, I mentioned the obscenity of not being able to take advantage of these all-time low interest rates. Now's the best time to borrow money for next to nothing in order to build the infrastructure we need to put a whole bunch of people back to work, and that would generate more and more consumption. And, you know, it's what Jack Kennedy says, a rising tide raises all boats. So, you know, another example of a great missed opportunity is the current low prices of gasoline, which has got people very happy. This would be a perfect time to just increase the federal gas tax just a little bit. That would help pay for this infrastructure. But, you know,
right.
Nobody wants to
talk. Decades.
Yeah, but nobody wants to talk about taxes. They're all nuts about it. Well, call it something else, for God's sake, you know?
Yep. Yeah, it's tragic. And part of the, you know, we can't get the political will to raise the gas tax by a nickel or a dime when gasoline prices a lot of places are under $2 a gallon, and yet we can, you know, talk about cutting taxes more and all these sorts of things. It makes no sense.
What?
And, you know, it's coming. I just came back from Europe and seeing the taxes there. I mean, there's a myth in the corporate tax debate that the U.S. has the highest taxes in the world. The first myth is that, yes, our tax rate is 35%, but the average company paid less than 20%. In the last 5 years. So that's myth number one. And the other thing that people miss is that most of the European countries have a value-added tax, which you know, most economists count as a tax on corporations since it raises the cost of their products. And if you added the corporate income tax in European countries, including the Greece and Turkey where I just came from, to the corporate tax rate, you'd find that European corporate taxes are just as high, if not higher, than the taxes that U.S. businesses pay.
Well, this proposal by Obama, a one-time 14% tax on an estimated $2.1 trillion of profits that are piled up abroad by big U.S. corporations like General Electric and Microsoft, Pfizer and Apple, etc. You said it was a bad idea, but he also says that Obama says he wants to impose a 19% tax on U.S. companies for future foreign earnings. So, in other words, it's a one-time 14% tax to get some money immediately. and then from then on it'll be 19%. So if the tax nominal tax is 35% and nobody actually pays anything like that, it's the average is 20%. So why not go with the 19%? At least it's more realistic. Or would they still avoid paying taxes on that?
Well, we think it just increases the incentive for gaming the system, and anybody that's paying taxes and subject to the 35% will find ways to move those profits offshore and then pay the 19% tax. So we think the president's heart's in the right place, but he is certainly starting the negotiations at a way too low level. He seems to have a habit of putting forth, you know, where he might hope to end up as his opening bid, and then gets nickel and dime down from there. So we would much rather a proposal that's in the mid to high 20s as an opening salvo for that foreign minimum tax.
So what is the fate of any and all of his proposals before this Congress? I mean, that's where, regrettably, the rubber hits the road.
Yeah, well, I think Congress has no willingness to collect taxes from businesses or rich people. So, you know, even if he put in a lower number, he probably wouldn't have a lot of success. There are a number of worse proposals in Congress to fund infrastructure through corporate tax holidays, some of which are offering rates as low as 8%. So, to the president's credit, he at least has a more meaningful number. We just think it's way too low, and it's rewarding the very corporations that have gamed the system and avoided their responsibility to pay taxes in the last few decades.
So what's going to happen here? We're just going to muddle along, and the momentum is on the side of the tax cutters. After all, you know, the Koch brothers bought a whole bunch of congressmen, and they're going to pay for the next election. They're going to raise as much money as either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party will to buy their congresspeople. And I suppose if you buy a bunch of politicians, their first duty is to pay you back with your legislation. So is that where America's heading, to becoming a playground for billionaires?
Well, I'm not optimistic in the very near term, because I think what you said is on the money. But I think the American public's getting more and more angry. And I just spent a week in Greece right before their election. You know, and it's pretty extraordinary what happened there, what's happening in Spain. People are rising up and saying, enough of this austerity, enough of my family suffering. I know who's running this country, who this country is being run for, and I don't like it. And what happened in Greece is a new political party that's now in charge of the government, because people were so fed up with the two parties that have traded places, the liberal and the conservatives, over the last many years, that they didn't vote for either of them. They voted for a new party that had values that said we put people before profits, and we put the safety and health of families ahead of the safety and health of foreign banks, and they're going to try a different path. And so I think that day will come in this country and probably other countries around the world that have continued to say that we are existing for the benefit of the few and at the expense of the many.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, we've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity, and was a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back to look into the President's $585 billion 2016 budget for the Pentagon.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
There's a wall we can't leave. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mandy Smithberger, who's the director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mandy Smithberger.
Thank you so much for having me.
And President Obama, in his budget, is asking for $585 billion for the Pentagon in 2016. Now, this is an increase. I thought we were supposed to be decreasing the French defense budget. So this is quite a reversal.
This is quite a reversal, and you really see the largest increase happening in the base budget for the Department of Defense, which means that you're not seeing an increase in the spending accounts for based on, you know, our overseas contingencies operations accounts for fighting wars.
So what's the increase then being attributed to?
A lot of the increase is going to hardware. So you're seeing more F-35 Joint Strike Fighters being purchased than originally planned, more P-8 aircraft, and really seeing a continuing prioritization of hardware over troops and personnel with proposed cuts to pay and benefits for our military troops.
So is this then the fingerprints of the new Secretary of Defense?
I think it's too soon to think that it's from the new Secretary of Defense. I think that you see an opportunity from a lot of the service secretaries' perspectives to try and increase spending, as there's hope that there can be some kind of grand bargain.
And what kind of grand bargain are we talking about? In terms of the sequester, to get rid of it?
Right. To get rid of the sequester, to increase taxes in order to be able to pay for more Department of Defense spending.
So that's the only way you can get rid of the sequester, is because this is the one thing that the Republicans and the Democrats agree on.
Right. Everyone agrees that sequester is a bad idea. One struggle for the Republicans is that there are fiscal conservatives who believe that sequester actually hasn't been so bad, hasn't really had major consequences, and don't want to see an increase in taxes in order to pay for what they consider to be Pentagon bureaucrat projects.
Well, this F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, of course, it's probably no accident that it's being assembled in Fort Worth, Texas. And there are contractors all around the country, and particularly here in Southern California in the aerospace industry. So is this the sort of business as usual tactic of spreading the money around to get the votes?
Correct. It's classic political engineering, making sure that you have subcontracts all over the country to ensure that you have congressional support for a program, no matter what the testing says as to how it's performing.
Well, but this F-35 is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what the final figure is because it keeps growing all the time. But every time I've looked into that airplane, it's nothing but dismay at how it's the sort of attempt to do everything in the one airplane, and it doesn't do anything well, and it's not as good as the planes that it's replacing. And yet it's the most expensive military weapon system in the history of man.
Right, with an estimated cost of $1.5 trillion. And in addition to that, to make budget room for this aircraft, we are retiring effective fighters and other jets like the A-10 that are incredibly useful to our troops and even in our fights against ISIL.
So I thought that some Congress people were fighting back against the Air Force efforts to cut the A-10 in order to pay for the F-35.
Yes, that's accurate. So far, Congress has rejected largely the attempts of the Air Force to retire the A-10, which is one more reason why this is kind of a fantasy budget. And it's not clear how they're going to be able to pay for everything that they want to buy.
Well, who's driving it? I mean, this is the budget that the president's submitting. So has he bought into the Air Force's, I hesitate to use the word logic, but their sales pitch for the F-35? Has he not heard about all the troops whose lives have been saved by the A-10 and the military, you know, those actual officers and men on the front line? As opposed to the Pentagon procurement people working in hand in glove with the contractors. It doesn't seem that nowadays you have to build anything that works. You just have to just build it as long as it's expensive and you spread the subcontracts around and everybody's happy, you know.
Right. Unfortunately, I think the president just hasn't been very engaged on this issue one way or the other.
Well, but who's he talking to? Is he still... I thought Chuck Hagel was supposed to be a bit of a reformer and... A lot of people are concerned that his replacement isn't. So I'm just trying to understand what's driving this increase in the defense budget, in the president's budget just announced.
I think that with the new incoming Secretary of Defense, you do get a lot of the conventional beltway thinking that this is a program that's too big to fail, that this is a program we need, the Joint Strike Fighter specifically is a program that we need too desperately, and if that means that we're going to take some short-term risk in the near term to be able to make this a successful program later down the line, that seems to be a sacrifice that they are willing to make.
And again, I'm speaking with Mandy Smithberger, who's a director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about President Obama's asking for $585 billion in the 2016 Pentagon budget, which is an increase. And we're trying to figure out why. And at this point, it looks like the increase is entirely due to hardware, in particular the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, that is the most expensive weapon system in history. And does Ashton Carter, the new Secretary of Defense, has he said anything about? And by the way, when does he start? When does Hagel end? And he hasn't been confirmed yet, has he?
No, he has not been confirmed yet. His confirmation hearing with the Senate Armed Services Committee is this Wednesday. So he has to be approved by the committee and then be approved by the whole Senate.
Right. So presumably in the hearings coming up this week, will he be asked about the F-35, do you think?
He'll absolutely be asked about the F-35. It's one of the programs that he focused on when he was the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisitions, Technology, and Logistics, and trying to slow down that program and reform it. And really, you can see that any reforms that occurred have been pretty cosmetic and insignificant compared to the significant challenges technologically and from a budget perspective this program is confronting.
So do you think he's just sort of given up? I mean, this seems to be almost sort of like a juggernaut that you can't stop.
Yeah, I have not seen any reason to believe that there is going to be significant oversight or restraint over this program under Ashton Carter. I hope I'm wrong.
Well, and what about the proponents of keeping the A-10, which the Air Force wants to get rid of? By the way, I never understood the logic of why the Air Force does this. Well, it's the brass that makes these decisions, and they seem to make them at the behest of the contractors as opposed to listening to their rank and file. They hated the extraordinary high-flying SR-71 program, which they got rid of because the take went to the CIA. So they flew the plane, but they didn't control the take, you know, the product of what the plane was photographing and recording. So they got rid of that because of the inter-service kind of peak, I guess. And what's the logic of wanting to get rid of the A-10? They just don't like the idea that the plane services the Marines and the Army, the guys on the ground?
Right. There is just a general lack of enthusiasm in the Air Force for the close air support mission.
So that's
in
it.
In particular.
Yeah.
Right.
So what are they in love with then? Just anything that's big and expensive that flies?
Right. They are in love with the Top Gun fighter jet and the idea of air-to-air fighting that we just don't really see as a realistic scenario.
So they're still back in that old Tom Cruise movie then?
Correct.
So what's then, you know, I take it that in terms of the drones, they're coughing up a lot of money for, what, 29 new Reaper drones?
Right, for $821 million.
Uh-huh. And so that's, nobody seems to disagree with that. Drones seem to be the flavor of the month, right?
It seems to be the flavor of the month, but I think that there are need to continue to be significant questions asked about whether this really helps our U.S. national security interests to continue to use drones as a tool, particularly with the number of civilians that get killed and just other issues with using this kind of quick fix.
Right. So you think the blowback issue will come up in the hearings this week before the Armed Services Committee in the Senate?
I hope it does.
Mm-hmm. And what's the latest on the previous Turkey that got through, the F-22? It had nothing but problems. And my understanding is it's not performing as well as the F-16s. And F-15s that it's replacing.
Right, and it's another program that we accepted with a lot of deficiencies. We've had to pay an additional $3.2 billion to just fix software and other retrofits that we should have had when the program was delivered. Mm. It continues to mostly be a hangar queen.
Meaning it doesn't fly very much.
Correct. It does not fly very
much. And for a while it was asphyxiating the pilots.
Correct. It was a real safety risk for pilots.
Presumably they fixed that, right?
Presumably. They haven't flown very many missions for us to see.
Right. Well, you know, it's pretty extraordinary that we're having this conversation, that the treasure of this country, the tax money of hardworking Americans, goes to incredibly elaborate and expensive weapon systems that don't work, and nobody seems to mind that they don't work. It doesn't seem to be an issue. I mean, it's one thing, you know, to spend a lot of money on weapons, but you'd think at a minimum, you know, you'd want them to work. As opposed, you know, I mean, it's a whole separate argument about whether we should be building this stuff and whether they were, you know, you mentioned drones with the blowback issue. But in general, you would think in a practical-minded world, people would expect at a minimum that these damn things worked.
Right. No, it's unfortunate that people seem to be more upset about a bad software package in their iPhone than they are about, you know, a jet that can't even identify friend from foe.
Well, specifically, what does that mean? You mean that this has been revealed in a test that it can't...
Right. Independent testing of the F-35 has revealed that at this point, the plane can't detect friend from foe.
So that could get very embarrassing, could it not? Not to mention deadly.
Yeah, deadly.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us here. I mean, I'm just, in dismay that nobody seems to be around to stop this, and least of all the President of the United States. He seems to have sort of caved in and decided to go along with the flow here with this $585 billion 2016 Pentagon budget.
Well, hopefully Congress will exercise some of their oversight powers and look at these programs more carefully.
Well, we live in hope, and I thank you for joining us here today, Mandy Smithberger.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Mandy Smithberger, who's a director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.